All right, good afternoon. I say I have no disclosures, but that's not entirely accurate. I am not an expert on burnout. What you're going to hear now is conjecture and opinion. This part will not be on the test. So what we have scheduled at the end is at least a half hour group discussion. I think that's probably going to be the most enlightening thing for all of us, is to kind of hear from all of you. So what I'm going to talk about is kind of my impression of what's going on, and it's mostly my opinion, as will become very clear to you in a moment. But we're all practicing the system that we didn't build, we didn't design, we had very little to do with any of the way things work now. And I can tell you, having spent 24 years now as a resident and as an attending, things can change. And I find that, you know, the most overwhelming feeling we get is like, this is just the way it is, and this is the way it's always going to be. But it's not the way. Things have gotten better and things have gotten worse. And I'm going to go through how I think we came to this point. So I'm going to start back in the early 1900s and talk to you about generation by generation how surgeons built this system. So the first generation is the so-called greatest generation, and these were guys born between 1900 and 1945. And people from this era generally valued hard work, discipline, and sacrifice. They were formed really by World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression. So anybody who lived in this era really had their kind of values fermented by these great calamities, really, that overcame the world. These were some of our best-known surgeons who kind of formed our modern system, Dr. DeBakey, Dr. Cooley, Rutherford, and others. Nearly all of them had served in the military because of the two world wars. So they were taught in the military, follow the rules, conform, chain of command is rules all. And so when they got back to the hospitals, that kind of came with them. So we didn't really have hospitals set up in the 1800s like we did in the last century. So this kind of country doctor came into the city or the town, they built this hospital structure, and what they set up was what they were used to, and that was a military chain of command. So it was a very hierarchical system, chain of command, where the person above you has absolute authority over you, essentially in every way. So I'm from New Orleans. This was a charity hospital. I took this picture. I may or may not have been in there to steal some instruments after Katrina, but anyway, I stopped in here and I took a picture, and it struck me, you know, we didn't use it as a surgical amphitheater when I was there, but, you know, in the past, that's what it was, and the surgeon, the god, would be at the center of this amphitheater, and then we would kind of lay ourselves out by hierarchy where, the chiefs would be at the bottom, and then the attendings, and then the residents, and then the students all the way at the top, seeing God knows what from that vantage point. But this is how we thought of ourselves, and we stratified ourselves, and we really found our value by our title and our position. So they did a lot of great things, this generation. I'm not here to disparage them. Many advances. They really established doctors as worthy of respect. You know, in the 1800s, doctors were more bound to do harm than good. So here they kind of reformed medicine, made us upstanding citizens in the world. But they were very inflexible, and abuse was common, probably from the military as well. So not only mental, but even physical abuse was just a common part of training in that generation. So the next generation, which I screwed up here, the baby boomers. So they were born after World War II, although they were really shaped by the aftermath of that war. And a lot of the things they drove them were really shaped by the aftermath of the war. These people are now mostly our chairs and our deans in our medical schools. So they were driven by the traditionals that came before them. You can imagine what people like the greatest generation who survived world wars and the Great Depression were like as bosses, probably not very tolerant of complaints. So the boomers were very driven by them, but they were more optimistic and more individualistic, and their goal became success. They couldn't get the kind of appreciation of their superiors, so they just tried to be successful in their own right. But the problem came when it came time to value that success, and how do you define success? So for them, it was mostly money, title, and recognition. So they drove themselves very, very hard to earn these things. So the 50-hour work week became 60, 70, 80, 90 hours just to try to get the money, title, and recognition. Boomers were dramatically successful, had some of the greatest surgical careers in our time, made a lot of money that we probably won't see again, and really had stellar careers. But this is where it happened. So it happened in the 50s and 60s, and we're somehow, as Ash just said, you know, the first step is to recognize the problem. Well, we're recognizing it in 2018, and this all happened in the 50s and 60s, where alcoholism, drug abuse, divorce, and suicide rates among surgeons were much higher than the general population. So we started doing this to ourselves 60 years ago. They made great contributions for us, for vascular surgeons as a specialty. We kind of got identified separate. Many other specialties, the same is true. And they were much more tolerant of minorities and women than their predecessors were as well, which led us to our diverse diversification, which was very important for the growth of surgeons. So now Generation X, which I am part of, so these are going to be the heroes of this story. So we were born between 1965 and 1981. We're now your chiefs and your program directors. We came in really trying to please the baby boomers ahead of us. We were much more likely to try to make them happy, make them proud of us than the boomers before us. We're more independent, more task-oriented. We had a great distrust of institutions that our predecessors did not have. And we were really the first generation to talk about a work-life balance, although arguably none of us really got there. We were latchkey kids, children of divorce. That led to some of our independence, some of our distrust of institutions. We all grew up on home computers and were kind of adapted to change. In the movies, we're kind of portrayed as slackers and disinterested. But really, it was that distrust of the system, I think, that we brought to the whole thing, and our value of freedom that led to a lot of dramatic changes in surgical training in the 1990s. So when I was a resident, you know, we had the 168-hour work week, which is how many hours there are in a week. We had pyramidable residencies, which probably a lot of you don't know what they are, and you should be thankful for that. And call was unlimited. You were on call when they said you were on call, you were off call when they said you were off call, and that was your call schedule. Call schedule could be decided that morning. So the Bell Commission in New York outlawed this practice and instituted the 80-hour work week. So if you talk to anybody of my generation, oh, when did that law pass? They'll say like 1999, 2000, because that's when we saw it. But it actually was enacted in 1989. So people of my generation basically were trained illegally for about 10 years before all these reforms came in. So again, we're task-oriented. We've been criticized for having short attention span, MTV generation. But we really drove the laparoscopic, the robotic, and the endo revolution that you see today. But it's our short attention span that probably leads to why we have a million different ways for vascular to treat the SFA. For you guys, I guess it's all the hernia meshes I saw downstairs. I don't know how many different kind of meshes you need to fix a hernia, but apparently thousands. So we've come up with a lot of different ways to treat the same problems. So then the millennials. Now, most millennials don't like being called millennials, but imagine being me, almost 50 years old, and they still call me Generation X. So millennials, not so bad. But millennials seem to have this ethos of, well, you can't please anybody, so why try to please anyone? But they have different values. They want meaningful work. They're much more civic, volunteer-oriented than my generation was, and much more team-oriented. My generation is very cutthroat. You know, the pyramidal residencies, when I was an intern, they fired a chief in the fourth year the first day I walked in the hospital. Like, this was just commonplace. So you had to look out for yourself. But the millennials are much more team-oriented. So when people of my generation kind of come across the millennials, we're a little bit baffled by this strange new person who has their self-interest at heart. But most millennials were raised by baby boomers, and the baby boomers were known as the me generation. So it's not all that surprising that they have probably a healthy self-interest that I think people in my generation never got. But when the boomers and millennials get together, there's conflict. The boomers think millennials are snowflakes, they're selfie-obsessed, they're scared to work, whereas millennials think that boomers are just authoritarians and can't stand to work for them. But the reality is they're probably very, very similar. They just are at different levels of the hierarchy. So I always thought it was kind of my generation's role to bridge this gap. The millennials have a lot of good going for them. They're much more self-aware than we were. They'll ask for help, something I was essentially forbidden to do. But it's probably better for the patient. You know, a lot of what I did independently probably shouldn't have been done. So the millennials know their limits much better than people from previous generations. So now that we've stripped surgical careers from status and massive salaries, millennials come in with a much more kind of holistic approach to surgery, since you're not going to make a lot of money and you're not going to have massive status anymore. But the system changes. We used to worry about cervical disc. A busy vasco surgeon do 300 cases a year. We had paper charts. Now in vasco, we worry about radiation. A busy vasco surgeon does over 1,000 cases a year. We have EMR. So we have to get adapted to all these changes. So a lot of what I told you, this generational psychology, the science is somewhere between astrology and drug-coated balloons, we'll say. But I do think there's inherent truths here, and I think if we look at how the system is and how we respond to it, we may get somewhere. Basically, I missed one. So here's how I see it in the millennials' hands. Here's what I think might happen. Millennials respect competency, not titles. Something Dr. Mitchell is always on about competency-based training. Millennials respect that. They respect people who know what they're doing. They don't necessarily respect somebody because they have a title of chief or chair. So we could switch then from a hierarchical network, hierarchical society, to more networks in medicine. Instead of the single all-powerful chair in charge of everything, maybe that will become a network where someone's in charge of education, someone in charge of business, someone in charge of research. So we do mainly what we're talented in rather than just take over everything because we're in charge. And I think it's important for people like me and older to remember that we've all differed dramatically from the generation before us. So it's not just something to kind of cast aspersions on the millennials that they're different than we are. I think they bring a lot of good into it. I want to get, so we got 3 minutes left, so I'm not going to go through all these surveys that I think we've gotten a lot out of. I want to get to a few points that I wanted. Well, one thing is that, you know, no matter what's happening, this is a big problem because we need more surgeons. And burnout is an issue that's making people retire early. So you can see we're the only specialty that's really projected to have a decrease in supply in the next 20 years. And there's currently no model that exists where the supply of surgeons will meet the demand by 2025. So we're facing a crisis on many fronts. In vascular surgery, we're facing crisis because our main competitors, interventional cardiology and interventional radiology, the two fastest growing specialties of any medical or surgical subspecialty. So we have issues there as well. Vascular, we have our own things. Dr. Goldberg and I wrote a lot of articles about it. But what I want to get to, and I'm going to have to skip a lot of slides to get there, these are all surveys we did, but and we've talked about EMR, and I'd like to hear your opinions on it too, because I have strong feelings on that. Malpractice needs reform. And there's all kinds of things, and we could talk about these paradigms. Stanford has tried a lot of innovative programs, but the problem is whenever I talk to somebody from Stanford, they've never heard about any of these things. So I'm not sure how widespread they are at Stanford. You know, it's just there's so many different ways we can change, but I think we have to be clear and focused on what we're going to try to change in our system. Ash mentioned briefly the four burners thing, and you know, I thought this is a lot of hocus pocus until I really stopped to think about it. This is actually very true. You can't do all four of these things well, and so what are you going to put on hold? Are you going to put your friends on hold? Are you going to put your health on hold? Are you going to put your career on hold? And it doesn't all have to be on hold forever, but what are you really going to emphasize, you know, now? And I'm actually going to cut myself off because I want to make sure we have the full 30 minutes for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, I would like to invite everybody for your questions. Please feel free to come up to the microphone.
We're happy to entertain comments as well.
Hi. My name is Becky, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm a member of the baby boomer generation. I have a millennial child, and I don't understand why they get upset about things. But anyway, thank you so much. This was a wonderful presentation. I'd just like to make a comment and a question. I retired early because of some of the things that you've talked about, and one of the reasons was is that I really found it almost impossible to pursue some of the interests that I had while working full-time. And even when my children left, even when you know, I was sort of free of some of these other things, and I think that we don't allow us ourselves to explore some of the things that we're really interested in while we're doing our careers. And some of that is the pressure of what our careers bring to us. I don't know how you solve that problem. I'm just making a comment. My other comment is that I think a lot of it is about expectations. My expectation was that I was going to go into this career and it was going to be this wonderful thing. And when EMR came along and my hospital was bought by a for-profit company, and the expectation that we were going to spend time doing things that took away from patient care. So I think the expectations that some of us had when we went into our careers has changes over time, and I don't think that was a good change. I don't know how that factors into this. And then my question is do you have any comments on how those of us who are burnt out physicians deal with this in our retirement?
I don't know how they did, but you did raise a couple of very interesting points, which ought to be thought about, and that is that you left medicine, and that's a cost, and it's an organizational cost. And in some work that has shown that the most severely burned out in an organization, if you look at them 24 months later, a significant proportion have gone from full-time to part-time or from full-time to no time. And we somehow have to make that loss in dollars apparent to organizational leadership, that retention of the workforce is critically important. I don't know how to make life after, for those who left medicine burned out, better, other than to say it's a tremendous loss. You brought your altruism to this field. It was beaten out of you. And where are the losers?
Yeah, I don't have a solution for you, but I can give you a couple of ideas. I'm going to tell you a vignette first. One of the cardiac surgeons who worked in my hospital was from Britain. And he stopped doing heart transplants at the age of 67 and wanted to go back to Great Britain, and he did. And he came back for a visit a couple months ago, and he said that 80 to 90% of his colleagues who retired in England were all alcoholics. And the problem is that these people were working so hard, and then somebody flipped a switch and they were not working anymore. And they found no purpose in life, and they turned to the bottles. So I don't think that that's a good idea. The idea that I'm going to present to you is that I come from Grand Rapids, where a lot of the physicians like to volunteer internationally. We send one of our third and fourth year residents to Africa for a month to work in a small hospital in Kenya. And I can tell you that 100% of the residents that go there come back so excited about what they did, because they really feel like they can help people, even in terrible conditions. They re-sterilize gloves, they don't have sutures, they don't have bovies, they don't have anything, and yet they come back so satisfied. And Dr. Mitchell actually volunteers, and maybe she can say something about that. So I think that that's an idea, is that to volunteer in a free clinic or internationally will bring the joy back into your practice. Another thing that some of the retired surgeons and anesthesiologists at our medical school have done is they volunteered with students. So they volunteer in the anatomy lab, and they volunteer in the simulation lab, and that brings joy to them. So try to get your question, try to answer it. I think it's a bad idea to go from working full-time to retiring all in one go. That's not a good thing to do. I think you should do it gradually. And I really believe, I counsel all my aging surgeons that they need to have a purpose in life. You know, you're working so hard and you're saving lives every day, and then all of a sudden you're at home doing nothing. That's not a good thing. You have to find some purpose in life, whether it's volunteering or doing some work that that's valuable.
Thank you. I just, I do like bourbon, but I actually agree with you. And I, one of the things that I've spent time at this conference, and I would encourage everybody here, is in the global surgery tract. And one of, I think American College of Surgeons has done a really wonderful job developing that tract over time. It was something that didn't exist when I came to these college meetings when I was a young surgeon. I have gone to Guatemala and done some things there, and I've done I'm very involved with that level. I would strongly encourage the college to create more structure for people as they go through this burnout phase. Something I'd like to see the college do is to have some more organized activity, because it's difficult to self involve sometimes.
I would say that abuse perpetuates abuse. So burnout, too, it's the same sort of thing. I think you need to recognize it in yourself. I'm definitely a victim of burnout. I left academics after being, getting to professor at 8 years, vice chair at 10 years. There was nothing left for me. So I'm now in a small rural setting. I've started a new practice, and we work 4 days a week. And it's equal. I work equally to my partners. There's no hierarchy. We take equal call. But I think what you need to understand is that it doesn't change unless you help change the system. The system won't change unless you make a change.
Hi, I'm Heather Loggy. I just wanted to share a recent experience doing a quick lit search. I was a little shocked to realize that conversations of suicide on doctors have been happening for a century. And one of the first articles on alcoholism and mental health was 1958. The term burnout came into being around 1977, so there was a lot of conversation on burnout in the 80s. There were legislative actions through like medical governing bodies in the 1980s and a big one in 2001. So it's not as new as it seems, and we're, for a group of people that like to succeed, we're failing. Mm-hmm. I wish I had the answer, but I do feel like it's important to realize that it's not new, so we really need to change the approach. Thank you.
You bring up a very important point, which we can do some things about, and that is this stigma attached to mental health issues in our practices. We look, when we are credentialed in the hospital, they ask me if I've ever had any mental illness. They don't ask us what my vision is and my family history of glaucoma. And there is a continued licensure in many states is dependent on not having mental health issues. And in reality, what physicians are doing is they're not saying anything. They're going to seek care with a different name in a different state. And how do we as a profession address a mental health stigma? And we play by those rules. We all have a credentials committee. We can start making it easier for those who are suffering to seek care.
Yes. So quickly, what I did realize is that in the 80s, it was a lot of, are doctors okay to practice? And so I think that is actually the approach that failed, was taking doctors out of practice is what's making everyone quiet. And I know many licensing boards right now require reporting of mental health, and that's a big issue. So I think you actually hit on a great point of why it hasn't worked.
The process that failed was that we thought we could just design our own system and go with it. So the reason people like me could work 168 hours a week is because I wasn't classified as an employee. I was basically an undesignated person, so they could do whatever they wanted to me. So one resident in my generation realized this and sued everybody, and we all got paid our Social Security tax back. Because if we're not an employee, we don't have to pay Social Security tax. So that was a nice... So I got 10 grand for all the hours I worked, but it's
dollar an hour.
The mistake was always that we knew what we were doing, and we only surgeons know how to train surgeons, and clearly we didn't.
Well, good evening. It's a very nice, interesting speech today and the topic. My question, I'm coming from El Salvador. I've been working with residents for around 25 years, and I've seen the changes in the residents, and as they become every year, they're coming new with a different expectation and a different attitude towards academic scientific surgery. And recently, we've been having a lot of troubles. We don't have the 80-hour policy, so they have to work a lot. The trouble that we're finding is that they get burned out very easily in the first months of the PGE-1. And so they have this excuse for not studying, and they look very much not interested in the academic part. They just want to be in the OR or with patients. And so I was just, my question is mostly if someone has already done some research on pedagogical approach to millennials, or if they have seen new tools for teaching to millennials, as now they have videos they can see in internet, whatever they want. They have databases. They can see many things now in live stream, whatever. But even that doesn't seem like to give them much interest. And so we've been searching for another way of approaching them to make them, for example, they don't feel responsible for patients. They don't go and see them after operating. And they just, you know, they get to the hospital, they just do the visit, and then they run to the OR. And would ask them, how's the patient? They said, they're not so sure, what's the patient doing? And so those things are really very much worrisome. And so I just want to know if someone has done some psychologically, pedagogically approach to teaching surgery. Thank you.
I'm not aware of any papers, but I think you hit on an important topic. I'm critical care certified, and I used to take shifts in our surgical ICU, and I would make rounds at like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and I see the residents, especially the junior residents, would have completed notes, but they'd never examine the patient, and I think we had to stop and say, it's not important to have the note done by 8 o'clock. What's more important is for you to go and examine the patient and give a report on what's going on, as opposed to just checking the box, yeah, the note is done, and I can go on and do something else. So I think we have to set that expectation, is that I don't care about the note. I care that you see the patient, examine the patient from head to toe, and tell me what's going on with the patient, as opposed to like finishing up your administrative duties.
Hi, evaluation.
You raise a very important point. Because I can speak as someone who practiced 50 years. To me, the most important thing was the relationship I had with patients and with their families. And the generation, all of us now, are moving from a relationship to transactional. You know, I can do all my banking, all my travel, with all my activities of daily living without having contact with any person. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're facing. And when we encourage residents that make the patient the icon on the computer and emphasize that, rather than as leaders of residency programs or hospital, to make sure that they have a curriculum and a program that allows them to develop the relationships with patients and families, which is what has sustained many of us for generations.
Hi, I'm Gene Riley. I am a trauma and critical care surgeon outside Philadelphia. And as a Generation Xer, I might be the last resident on Earth who went in on a Saturday at 7 a.m. and didn't leave until Monday at 6 p.m. And so I'm still astonished that we're, in some circles, litigating work hour restrictions, because it was so inhumane that I don't think people really get just how bad it was. So there was a lot to unpack, and this was really great. So I'm going to try not to ramble too much, but I'm also boarded in clinical informatics, and I'm a little sensitive about the scapegoating of the electronic medical record, because like many build issues that we find when we're building interfaces for the different practices and individuals, it's almost always the case that when we run into snarls, it's because it's illuminated something that's wrong on the human side, not the other way around. And you know, in terms of like the length of the notes, the note bloat, it's, you know, in my experience, it's because the residents have been told again and again, explicitly or implicitly, to put as much in there as possible to be able to bill at the highest level, which is bad in and of itself. But it's a total ignorance of what the actual rules are, which is just that the because, you know, the reality is that American doctors, in relation to their peers in the world, probably make more than is sustainable. And so, you know, there's this big impetus to get people to bill as much as they humanly can. But you could also just say, like, I reviewed the labs, and that's it. You don't have to write every lab that's in the chart for the last week, which is what I usually see, or every word that's in every radiologic interpretation for the last week. And that's what leads to 22-page notes that look like stereo instructions. And so we fought really hard against that, and just as much as we can in the note, don't link any information in and make people write out their thought process, and it allows people to be good writers again, which is what I think is really lacking.
Yeah, so I do think there's a correlation between the programs that support EPIC, like the institution supports huge amounts of underground work on that versus making the physician do it. You can see it in some of the small hospitals versus academic hospitals where the amount of EPIC support you get is it's very different.
Yeah, so I actually am a physician builder with EPIC. And so I work for Penn, although I'm mostly at Reading Hospital. And it is amazing to that end how bad the bureaucracy leads to these struggles that are irreconcilable. Because at Reading Hospital, it's much more kind of community-like, and they were much more willing to allow the physicians to be engaged in the build of the interface and how it works. And it's much more congruent with our practice, and I think in general, the providers across the organization are much more satisfied, at least with the way they interact with the EMR, as opposed to the Penn side, where they are completely uninterested in having providers do any build or design work. Yeah. And I think that it shows. And that is another big contributor to the friction, the internal friction that people have when they're trying to use this tool to help them do their work.
Yeah. EPIC's customer was who was paying them. And that was the organization. And so if the organization wanted better billing or better documentation, that need was met. And there was satisfaction in organizational leadership with EPIC and with Cerner. But the user are the physicians. And that relationship was not nourished. And now realize that it's something that we need to do as we go forward.
And hence the physician builders. So thank you for your insight.
Hi, my name is Marissa. I'm a PGY4 resident in Kansas City. I really enjoyed the talk, so thank you guys. I just wanted to share something that came up at a house staff council. I'm on our house staff council, which is a group of residents from all different specialties at our university. And we were all talking about burnout in our respective specialties, and everyone has experienced it, as we know. But one thing that we were talking about was just kind of the administration overload that we're faced with. And in our institution, for example, almost every week have someone come in from Cerner saying that you need to check 8 more boxes to, you know, show that you're doing this VTE advisor. And one of the things that we all came up with, you know, we were talking about how we all just, that some residents don't feel like they have time if they needed to do like any wellness activities, like talk to a counselor or take a day off to go to a doctor's appointment. And one of the things that we are going to approach our administration about is getting more APPs to kind of distribute that work, so that, you know, we could have more time with patients, we could have more time to be in the OR, and these kind of administrative things that keep coming up, we can kind of distribute that and not just put it all on the residents, so maybe we have time for other things.
Just recognize that your value is less than APP in terms of monetary. So that's why you're treated that way.
So, thank you. I want to start maybe with a question for the audience, if I may. I'm just curious by show of hands, how many audience members are still in training and how many are faculty? So if you're in training, and how many faculty are present? And of the faculty present, how many have educational leadership roles? So it's enjoyable to see that. One of the things that, I don't know if it's part comment, part question, but that I think it's important to keep in mind, particularly if we are focusing this talk on resident well-being, is that as faculty, I think residents model what we do, right? So they see, you know, they're keenly aware of what's stated and what's not stated. And so at the organizational level, you know, that's, I think, where the faculty well-being will come into play, because, you know, until next July, we're not going to have that, you know, the faculty well-being that's going to be mandated, the assessments, et cetera, that it is for the residents. So for the chairs who are on the panel, what interventions have you taken at your own institutions to address faculty well-being with the idea that, you know, the faculty have that influence on the residents, and that's really a well-being continuum? Are there things that you've done at this point in your own programs?
So the approach we're taking is to have some faculty development programs, or send the faculty to meetings that talk about this, so that they can A, recognize it, and B, be good role models for the residents and the students. It's a complex problem. It's one of the things, I'll tell you frankly, one of the issues that we had, especially in surgery, is that my first day of being an intern in surgery, the associate dean came and he said, I trained at Johns Hopkins in 1953 or whatever it was. And he said, I came in to the hospital on July 1st and I didn't leave until my residency was done. Because in the 1950s at Johns Hopkins, they gave you your uniform, your white uniform. You came into the hospital and you never left until you finished. And until recently, the surgery residency was modeled on how William Stuart Halstead designed a surgery residency, which was that model. You came in as an intern and you basically spent your entire time in the hospital, which, you know, zero recognition of your humanity and that you needed to have a family and time to yourself. It was expected of you to be there for the attending surgeon and for the patients, period, and a discussion. So we're flipping this a little bit now. We recognize that this is unhealthy. And I'll admit that I can't change everything overnight, but it's gonna take time and effort to do things bit by bit and recognize that there's a problem and make sure that, you know, we have systems in place to address these issues. And I think, you know, I don't want anybody to get hurt, at least one of my trainees or students or residents, so.
Yeah. I just would like to add one more comment, if I may. I think sometimes as faculty or as chief residents, there's the initial reaction to perceived lack of work by the resident, right? The resident didn't respond to their pager. The resident came in late for work. This person is lazy. And so I just want to caution everyone, you know, that disengagement can be one of the first signs of burnout. So just keep that in mind before you are, you know, pointing the finger at the lazy resident, that may be their silent call for help, the fact that they are not coming in at the appropriate time and things like that. So that, that may be one step to early recognition, that when you start to see that disengagement by the learner, that they may deserve some caring approach rather than a punitive approach.
Yes, very true.
Thank you for that.
So that was all a Ponzi scheme, right? So the Halstead thing, you get in there, you work your ass off for 5 years, you get out and you're gonna be rich and you're gonna run the hospital. And it didn't sustain, right? In the beginning it did, and they all got rich and they all ran the hospitals, and right around my generation, everything fell apart. So this is what we're seeing, and the millennials are looking at this now like, well, what are you talking about? Like, none of this makes sense. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't make sense. I don't know why I did it, but we did. So this is what I mean when we have to reorganize, and we're left really not knowing what to do most of the time, because that was the system we trained in, where this is how you learn surgery. You learn surgery by just living it day and night. And now we have to be more efficient, and we're trying to come up with ways to do it, but it's hard. But I think now we're in that transition.
Martine Louis from Flushing, New York. I thank the panel for a great presentation. I think that there's a big elephant in the room that we are not addressing. The burnout, I think it's a general burnout that goes beyond surgery, that goes beyond other specialties. I think the human in human being is slowly disappearing. We have gadgets that we're on 24/7. We do not call our parents. We do not lay eyes on each other. We do not talk mm-hmm. to one another. I don't think that the burnout is ever going to stop. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. And how do we want our resident to attach to the human being that they're taking care of, because there is no time? Because I have to do this, and somebody's calling me for that. I have to go to the OR. I didn't finish my notes. So that person becomes X, Y, and Z. So that is why they'll tell you the patient has pain worsening, but they've not examined the patient. The patient will be throwing up. They did not know. The intern told them, and as a chief resident, they did not go. And I think it's scary from a human being point of view, because I don't know how it's going to stop, because there's more and more that we're adding, and people are detaching themselves from one another more and more. We have created so many gadgets supposedly for us to interact, but we email, we tweet, we twat, we do so many other things, but we are not connected. So I don't know if you have an answer to that. I don't. But I think this is a big elephant in the room that we just maybe the only thing we can do is stop. Ask them. I'm part of the resident well-being committee in my hospital. It's very small, but I'll sit with them for 10, 15 minutes. How's your wife? How's your baby? Just connect. Remind them that they are beings, that we are beings, and that the patient is a being. That patient in room 450 is Mrs. So-and-so, who has 3 kids and 2 grandchildren, and she's dying, but all of these people are around. We're talking about their potassium, but we don't tell them, your grandma is going to die.
Very astute.
Yes. Hello, thank you. I'll be quick on the last comment. I'm Vamsi Arabindi. I'm a general surgery resident at the Baylor College of Medicine. I know we've talked a lot about duty hours here. I'd like to actually point out that I don't think it's hours that are really the problem. I think it's always been intensity. What I mean by that is this. I mean, at Baylor, we still take a lot of home call for our patients, which I actually enjoy on multiple services. I mean, I took home call for a month straight, and it was fine because our list was relatively low. There weren't too many consults, and every time I got a call, it felt fine because I knew I was the best person on the planet to take that call. I mean, I knew them inside and out, and it was a very meaningful work at our county hospital. But on the other hand, other services where you're an intern cross-covering 80 patients, 90 patients, or like multiple ICUs, and you have no idea who they are running and putting out fires all night, I mean, that was far more, even though the hours may have been like less cumulatively, it was much more grating, if you will, than the latter category. And on that subject, making another comment is in terms of responsibility and I guess meaningfulness, I think we have to realize that our work is a very difficult one morally. I mean, we have the responsibility for another person. Like the more I've gotten more and more time in this job, I realize that can weigh on you. I mean, your bad outcomes are somewhat your fault, because we're not perfect. We all make mistakes, and some of those mistakes actually do hurt people. And that's incredibly, like, tears at you. And not only that, even if you don't make a mistake, you see so many people suffering all the time. I mean, most of our patients are in pain from post-op or pre-op, and it's a lot of very difficult work. And if you look at professions that deal with it every single day, I mean, lawyers, police officers, I mean, even military officers and or military enlisted personnel, they do have very high rates of psychological distress and problems. And so maybe we shouldn't expect a full 40, 50, 60-year career out of every single surgeon. Maybe we should just stay as long as you can. I mean, help out and do the work that you love, and try to inculcate that. And when you have, obviously, maybe we should probably make some more counseling resources available to all of our surgeons. But in the end, if someone says, you know, this is too much for me, that may not be a bad thing. I mean, in the end, better to recognize that this work isn't something that's nothing on that person, but maybe this work is not something that people are necessarily meant for, and that's totally fine too.
Thank you. We'll take this last question in respect for time.
So my name's Jeff Smith, and I thank the panel. I know some of you on the panel, so appreciate you doing this for the residents. I think that the comment or question asked earlier, what you can do in retirement, I would say it's also what you can do throughout your career, which is to mentor, coach, teach, whatever residents' survival strategies. I experienced burned out in my career and looked back at it as I started to get into this issue, kind of denying that it actually existed. Now I acknowledge it, and now I'm even at the point that I experienced burnout this week, but I process it and manage it like a chronic illness, and I'm hoping to sustain my clinical career for many, many more years. But whether I do it in retirement or whether I do it in my practice, I'm going to help others with the process. And I think that's important for us all to do. I probably had another comment, but I forgot it, and I know there's a time issue. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there should be no shame in admitting you have burnout.